Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike Vassaf, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Our guest this week is Ben Hinden, former U.S. Army Ranger and founder of Bear Hug Cattle Company, a nonprofit that's providing veterans with resources, technical knowledge, and funding to support those who are interested in a career in the ranching industry. Through their 10-week intensive course, transitioning service members will gain confidence in horsemanship, ranching skills, basic ranch economics, and field training at some of the more historical ranch operations in the Western United States. Despite growing up in the suburbs in New Jersey, Ben became an avid fisherman and hunter, although he admits that he never ate any of the fish out of the New Jersey River. It's not often that a guest on this show has no connection to the military prior to joining, but in the few instances that this is the case, there is usually a common event that many cite as their catalyst for joining the uniformed service: 9/11. At West Point, Ben fell in love with this idea of being a part of a high-functioning team and deployed with those types of teams to both Iraq and Afghanistan. He shares a story from one of those experiences that he cites as one of the coolest 10 seconds of his entire military career. Have a listen to find out what that story is and what happened, but also what Ben is learning as he transitions these skills into other high-performing teams at the Harvard Business School, and the work he's doing with his nonprofit, Bear Hug Cattle Company, across much of the Western U.S.
My dad's a carpenter, and my mom is a graphic designer. I have a brother who's a year older than me, who's a mechanic, and a sister who's 2 years younger than me, who's a school teacher. So I grew up in kind of suburban New Jersey, and just from the time I was a little kid, was just obsessed with hunting and fishing and all that stuff. And so I spent most of my time outside playing around fishing or hunting for most of my early childhood, and just had a really exceptional family structure to do that in. So it was a really cool place to grow up and really neat.
How far outside of the suburban area did you have to go to be able to get some good hunting and fishing in?
Yeah, so I actually fished a lot in the suburban area. Okay. So there was a river right by my house that actually ran straight to New York City, right past Giant Stadium and all the way to New York City. So me and my buddies would take out a small little John boat, and we would cruise around and disappear for a couple days on that river.
That's
and
right.
Do a bunch of fishing. But to hunt, you know, maybe 30, 40 minutes west to get to some really good hunting. And it's actually, you know, at this point, I've hunted and fished all over the country. And New Jersey, although it doesn't seem like it, has a really good state managed hunting program.
Whitetail?
So there's a whitetail, and then upland birds is what I did.
Oh, wow.
Mostly.
Okay.
Yeah. So they have, you know, tens of thousands of state managed hunting land, and they do a really good job with the pheasant hunting and the deer hunting there. And so it was, you know, it was an exceptional place to grow up hunting. It doesn't really compare to hunting out west, but
yeah,
you know, it was really
right.
Cool for being 30 minutes away from New York City.
What I haven't heard you say yet, Ben, is a relationship or a connection via familial or otherwise to the military. How did that become into your sphere of doing, so to speak?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question. I had never met anyone in the military until I basically showed up at West Point, which is where I went to college. So this has kind of been a question that I've tried to figure out along the way as well, is what gave me that initial push to want to join the Army. So part of it was growing up so close to New York City. I remember standing on top of the hill near my house as a kid on September 11th, and I was looking at the smoke from the Twin Towers, and there was this huge sentiment in that area, you know, a lot of national pride and unity around that. And so that, and I was in third grade when that happened. So That was a pretty significant motivator for me, but still, even in the Northeast, there aren't a ton of people who join the military. And so I just had no connection to it whatsoever. And so I came home one day when I was a teenager and I told my mom that I was going to join the Marines. And she looked at me and laughed and said, "No, you're not." And at that age, I didn't know that you were allowed to just say no to your parents. And so I just said, "Okay, I guess I'm not joining the Marines." But I still wanted to do it. And my mom and dad have no military connections either. And my mom basically said, "Hey, I think there's a way you can go to college and still be in the military." And so she stuffed me in the car and drove me down to Annapolis, to the Naval Academy, and poked someone on the shoulder and asked them if they could show me around and tell me, you know, how to go to college and be in the military. 'Cause at that point I was still interested in doing the Marine thing. And so they toured me around and I found out what Marines do, as a job. And then she also took me up to West Point, New York, which was about an hour and a half from where I grew up, and did the same thing, grabbed someone and said, "Hey, can you show my son around?" And, they took me around and I found out about what people in the Army do. And, at that point I was totally sold on the idea of the Army. They tricked me real good with the videos of helicopters and guns and all that stuff. And so
they've got a good recruiting push.
Yeah. Yeah. So they got me real good. And then, I honestly, had never even really interacted outside of those very limited interactions. I'd never interacted with anyone from the military until the first day I showed up at West Point, to do the basic training and all that stuff. So I had no context.
What a culture shock, right? Being able to jump in something like that with having no background in it whatsoever.
Yep. I loved it. I think, one way or the other, I was going to end up in the military just based because of my personality. And I love to be just moving forward, and I love the structure. I love the discipline. The biggest thing for me was to just get to be on like a team of really good people. And so that whole experience is just curated around teams, teams and leadership. And so I although I had no exposure to it growing up, I showed up there and just really fell in love with the whole lifestyle of it.
Was this attraction to kind of an elite team, so to speak, is that what ultimately drove you into special forces in the Army, or was it something else that kind of moved you in that direction?
Yeah. So I graduated from school and commissioned as an infantry officer, and went
that?
To the, in 2015.
Okay.
So I graduated from school, commissioned as an infantry officer, and then moved down to Fort Benning, Georgia, where I went to Ranger School, Airborne School, the infantry, basic officer leader course. And just, I was there for 9 months. I did a bunch of schooling. And then from there, I still very young in the Army, had an interest in special operations, but in the Army, you can't do any, jobs in special operations until you have done a job in the conventional Army. Okay. So I went to the 101st Airborne, which is out of Fort Campbell. And that's a really, really amazing first unit, ton of history, ton of pride. The guys who did the D-Day invasion. And at the time that I got there, I went to 3rd Brigade of the 101st. It was the most consistently deployed conventional Army brigade in the Army at the time. And so just around a ton of guys with crazy amounts of combat experience and leadership. And I met there my first platoon sergeant, a guy named Chris Magley, who is a lifelong friend, probably the most influential person who I've ever met in the Army, and just an absolute amazing leader. And so I showed up there in May, and then I think at the end of that summer, left for my first deployment to Afghanistan, which I ended up spending 9 months there as an infantry platoon leader on that trip. And then
this is 2016, early 17,
yep.
16.
Yeah, 16, 17. And so
what part of the country?
So my battalion was the theater response force out of Bagram.
Okay.
And then we kind of splintered off from there as the deployment moved on, and we went and did a host of other things. So, and on that deployment, I got exposure to both Special Forces and Ranger Regiment. And so I made the decision on that deployment that when I came home, I was going to apply to assess for the 75th Ranger Regiment, which is ultimately what I ended up doing, and ended up in 3rd Ranger Battalion.
Is there a particular story, Ben, or experience from either of those two deployments that sticks with you today, either something that you experienced that you draw on or something that happened that you kind of shaped the way you view something today?
Yeah, there's a couple. There's one story that I kind of go back to a lot, which informs a lot of my kind of decision making now. So again, on my first deployment to Afghanistan, I was maybe 24, infantry platoon leader, very green in the sense, in all senses. And we were operating in a kind of partner capacity out in one of these valleys. And my battalion had had a couple of guys get killed the week prior, right next to us. And because of that, they had mandated that like the platoons had to stick together in this really, you know, tight physical capacity, right? So no splitting the platoons in any way, shape or form as a reaction to those guys getting killed. So the Special Forces ODA we were working with and the Afghans we were working with, we came up with a plan one day to have the ODA and the Afghans go up one side of the valley while we kind of maintained a base of fire on the other side.
Describe what an ODA is quickly, Ben, for those who may not know.
It's a Special Forces Operational Detachment Alpha. It's a 12-man special operations team that manages partner forces.
Okay.
So they were in charge of managing the Afghans. That was their primary mission, was to manage and coach the Afghans in that scenario. Okay. And then we were kind of just there as a traditional infantry capacity.
Okay, got it.
Yep, so we were on one side, they kind of left and went up the other side a few hundred yards away. They ended up getting into a pretty serious gunfight, and then had, you know, a half dozen guys get injured at once, and that will slow the operation down pretty quickly. And so we had to make a decision. Basically, they called back to us and had asked us to come replace them in that position. We only had enough trucks to do that with half of the platoon, so we would have had to split the platoon to go do that. And so I really quickly ran downstairs. I was on the roof of a building, and I found Chris Magley, my platoon sergeant, and I looked at him and I pulled him aside and said, hey, here's the situation. You know, they need us to go over there and kind of relieve them, knowing that we had just been directly ordered to not do that, in essence, by splitting the platoon. And I was like, what do you think about this? And he said, you know, I'll support you in whatever decision that you want. This was one of the coolest 10 seconds in my 10-year Army career, was, you know, this guy who had, this was his 6th combat deployment that he was on. He had 15 years of experience. He had Valorous Awards. This guy is a legitimate war hero. And he looked at me, a 24-year-old kid, and said, you know, I'll support you in whatever you want to do. He said, just know that if you do this and you split this platoon, like, you're going to get fired. But he's like, that being said, I will support you in whatever you want to do, but at the end of the day, you're the one who has to make that decision. And so I looked at him and I said, all right, let's go. And so, and I tried to call my commander on the radio, couldn't get in touch with him. So we just made the decision to do it anyway. And that was one of the coolest experiences I had in the military, really, up until that point, because it just highlighted so much stuff that, you know, and this is lessons that I've taken into the future as a leader, whether it be in the military or in business or in agriculture. You know, ultimately, there's a lot of times that the decision is going to land on your plate, and you need to be as ready as you can be to handle that. And there's a lot that goes into that. And the other thing too, that really is the big takeaway from that one for me, was that although I was going against something that was explicitly told to me, you know, I thought that I was kind of going with the bigger mission at large. And so that was a really big thing that I wrestled with for a long time of, you know, is it right to do what your boss says, or is it right to do the thing that accomplishes the mission the best way? Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's something that I still think about all the time. And so, it was a really neat experience, and, definitely a lot of takeaways from that one.
What happened?
So I ended up getting in touch with my commander later that night, and was very honest with him because I didn't want him finding out that we had split the platoon up from someone else. And so I got him on the radio later that night, and I told him the situation and laid it out and said, you know, we split the platoon. I just wanted to be upfront with you about this. And he took a pause and said, don't ever do that again, but like, you made the right decision. And so I ended up not getting fired for that one, which was a big win.
Fast forward, you know, at the end of the 10-year career, what does your transition process look like? What are you thinking about next? Where'd you end up right afterwards?
Yeah. So that's really getting into the meat and potatoes of the story, but, so I had finished up my time as a platoon leader in 3rd Ranger Battalion and was at the Maneuver Captain's Career Course, which is, mm-hmm. you know, the transition school for Army Infantry officers to go into the next job. And I started kind of thinking about where I'd been and where I wanted to go. And I for the first time, at that point, it had been 6 years since I had commissioned. And I started thinking about all the opportunities I've had and what I wanted to use them for going forward. And for the first time, I kind of started to consider maybe potentially doing something outside of the military. And it really had never even crossed my mind until that point. And so I started to kind of dig into that, maybe what I would be passionate about, what I would be interested in doing. And I got the idea through talking to a bunch of mentors and family and friends that, you know, potentially getting out of the military could be a good choice, and potentially landing in business school afterwards could be a good time to develop out some things that I wanted to build. One of them in particular was a nonprofit that actually helped veterans transition out of the military and into agriculture. And so we were pretty heavily invested in developing that at this point. And so I made the decision basically a year ago, so the summer of 2020, to get out. Long story short, ended up in Italy doing some staff work over right outside of Venice at the AFRICOM headquarters. Spent 6 months there and then came back and started the transition process, which was a very interesting process, to say the least.
Yeah. What about that particularly for you was challenging or went the way you thought it would?
Yeah. First of all, the transition process out of the military was terrifying. I went to West Point 6 days after I graduated high school, and I've been in the Army since then. And then all of a sudden I was 28 and having to think about getting a job and having to think about getting healthcare and having to think about what it would be like to wake up in the morning and not walk into the team room and sit on the couch with the guys and go to the shooting range and jump out of planes. And so, you know, that's a daunting thing to think about when for 10 years, all you've known is being on a small, high performing, awesome team. That first step out was to Montana for me.
Okay. So what's the connection there?
Yeah. So again, back to the hunting and fishing thing, I had been going out west to fly fish in Montana since I was a teenager and fell in love with it. And to backtrack for a half second, when I was still in the Army, I ended up getting pretty involved in the Western industry. So I started riding horses and training horses and working with a bunch of guys, went down, I was stationed at Fort Benning, and ended up showing and competing and cutting horses and doing a bunch of rope and working on a bunch of ranches down there. Through that, started a nonprofit that was aimed at getting guys in the military the ability to transition from the military into the ranching world. So we had been running that program in Georgia, North Carolina for about a year, and made the decision to move it out to Montana. because the community out there is just much more conducive to that program. Mm-hmm. And so I left the military and went straight out to Montana and started kind of building out what the Montana edition of that program would be. And then, so I basically spent 4 or 5 months in Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and Idaho setting up that program.
At that point, it sounds like you already had 4 to 5 months of solid business experience in an OJT type capacity. I mean, did you then decide to step back into business school? I mean, why not just continue with the success that you'd had in Montana with the nonprofit?
Yeah, so I had made the decision to go to business school, you know, at this point, a year prior to showing up in Montana. And it was really cool to get all this experience, you know, incorporating a nonprofit and doing all the business things that come with that. And my rationale on going to business school is I want to grow this nonprofit into being, you know, the most successful veteran transition nonprofit in the country. And I, my thought process is like, if I'm going to be asking for people's money to donate to this cause, I want to make sure that I'm doing all the things that I can to be a good steward of their money. And so that was my motivation for going to business school, is to get the skills necessary to take this nonprofit that was an idea that turned into something small. And I want to have the tools necessary to turn it into the best version that it can be.
Okay. And where are you going to business school now?
So I'm at Harvard Business School up in Boston. I did a lot of research into different business schools, and everyone I talked to pretty much unanimously said that if you're going to do the business school route, to come to a school like Harvard or Stanford. And so I ended up deciding to go to Harvard Business School because the network of people that go to this school, they do an incredible job of trying to curate an experience where you are around the most diverse group of people you'll ever be around in your life. And that's not, you know, unique to Harvard. There's other schools that do that. But this school is really focused on relationship building, meeting people in all different industries and sectors across the world, from a wide range of backgrounds. And then it's also really focused on leadership. So where a lot of other business schools are focused on getting really good at the financial side of the house or the tech startup side of the house, Harvard's program is, again, explicitly focused on teams and leadership in the context of business. And so that was the most attractive thing about it to me, is to be around a really diverse group of people all thinking about leadership. And so that's what drove me in this direction.
So are you both simultaneously running a nonprofit in Montana and going to business school? Talk about that program, Ben. What are you doing out there?
Yeah, so our program, like I mentioned, aims to take veterans who are transitioning or have recently transitioned from active duty and gives them the skills and resources necessary to get involved in the agriculture industry, specifically on the cattle side of the house. So what that looks like is it's a 10-week program, and the first 4 weeks are all basic horsemanship in Bozeman. And so just horsemanship 101, and we have a variety of industry experts who are just some of the most phenomenal horsemen in the country who come out and help the guys get up to speed on how to safely handle horses and get the most out of that experience. And then during that first 4 weeks when we're in Bozeman, we're also doing, you know, classes as well. So there, a company called Harvest Returns is going to come up and do,
We talked about this. Yeah, I know those guys. Okay.
Yeah, they're going to come out and do basically a ranch economics class for a few days with us, so the guys can start to understand what goes into this process, what's the business side of this, and start to understand how that all comes together. And then after those 4 weeks of the fundamentals in Bozeman, we go on the road for 5 weeks, and we start out in Wyoming on the ID Ranch. And the guys will get exposure to a traditional branding at a cow-calf operation with Will Hudson and his crew. And that's one of the just the coolest experiences ever. And from there, we'll go work at a bunch of different ranches all throughout Wyoming, Colorado, and Montana. And the idea is that the people in the program will get exposed to all different kinds of ways to do the cattle business, and they'll meet all the connections in the industry that they'll need to meet to be successful.
Have you run folks through here through this program yet?
Yeah, we have. And it's been on a really small individual scale thus far. So in Georgia and North Carolina, we had the ability to do one or two guys at a time, and it was nowhere near a structure or formal. And it would go over a much longer period of time. So someone might come out, you know, every weekend for 3 months, or, you know, if they had a week off, they would come out for that week. And it would just kind of depend on what we were doing at the time with the horses and the cattle in those locations. And so we kind of took a tactical pause and said, okay, we're, you know, the interest had outgrown our ability to resource it. And so we took a step back and said, okay, let's think about where we want this program to go and how we can do that. And what we came up with is move it out to Montana, consolidate everyone to going through at one time, make it 10 weeks, start the fundraising process to get all the horses and trucks and trailers and all the logistics that goes into this whole program. And so we had been running it on a segmented individual basis in North Carolina and Georgia. We took that pause and said, okay, we're gonna coalesce everyone, and we're gonna structure this a little bit better. And then we're gonna prep for this 9 months from the end of this summer until the beginning of next summer. And we're gonna really set ourselves up for success to run that consolidated program out west.
So your first consolidated full-scale program will be 2022, summer of 2022.
Correct. Okay. Yep, start in May 29th of 2022.
Is the output or the goal of the program at the end of what, 10 weeks? Is it to have guys and gals who are capable of being cowboys, so to speak, on other cattle ranch operations? Or is it to have them begin their own cattle operations and then understand what's required to operate them?
Yes, is the answer to that. So correct. We want the veteran to go through the program to have the skill. Again, they won't in 10 weeks have a lifetime of knowledge to go run a huge ranch out west. But what they will have the skills and resources to do is go get a job on a ranch out west and continue to grow and learn and develop in their new profession. The other piece of that is they hopefully, through all the finance and instruction that they get, they'll have the ability to think about if it's right for them to start their own operation at scale. And so those are kind of the two outcomes we're looking to achieve, is someone can go get a job on a ranch, or they have the ability to assess whether or not they want to do it on their own, and what it would look like to actually do that.
Is there a cost to participants to be a part of the 10-week course?
Nope, there are no costs to participants. So we're incorporated as a 501c3. Mm-hmm. So we're largely exclusively donation funded at this time. And so our goal is to have this course be completely free for the veterans. And we're working towards our fundraising goals so that that is the case next summer.
Right. Do you have a certain number of folks already signed up for the May 29th start date?
Yeah, we do. So just based on all the constraints and logistics and all the travel and everything, our maximum capacity right now is 4 veterans in the program. Okay. And we already have 4 veterans identified for next summer. And we're right now, again, the interest is exceeding our resources. And so we're storing the data on the people who are interested. And as we continue to grow and scale and can do more and offer this program to more people, we're going to continue to keep everyone tied together to make sure that anyone who wants to get into this industry and have the help to do it, we're going to help them in some way, shape, or form.
And when you were starting these relationships, was it always the intent to create this 10-week veteran-based educational job pathway course?
So those relationships were curated just because I love spending time with those guys.
Sure.
They're the culture in that community is amazing. And I needed that when I got out of the military. So I had the idea for the structuring the nonprofit into this 10-week course at this point. And I started having conversations with all these ranch managers in the West and kind of talking to them about if this was a feasible idea, would people be open to supporting it? And the feedback I got was unanimously positive. And everyone was just really fired up about it and super, super amped up to help out in any way they could. And so we, you know, put this plan together and we've just been building it out ever since. And it's been amazing. So
how are you pulling those resources together now?
Yeah. So we have been getting donations from a lot of really generous people who believe in what we're trying to do. And that's kind of been able to fund us in the interim. We're developing a fundraising campaign right now. And what we're going to do is build up to a big fundraising week in the end of December, where we're going to ask a lot of people if they'd be willing to participate with us in this program build. And that'll fund basically next summer's program. And then after we do that, we're going to continue to just have a more sustainable fundraising model. And then, so that's the financial side of the house, but, you know, people from all over have been reaching out and donating tack and saddles and, you know, we've been borrowing horses and trucks and trailers and all this stuff. So, you know, all the physical resources are starting to come together. The financial resources are starting to come together. So we've just been chipping away at this gigantic gap between what we have and what we need, slow and steady, but it's been really awesome to work through that.
What are those biggest expenses right now, Ben? Is it trailers? Is it horses? Is it, you mean, are you renting time from these different places in Colorado and Wyoming and Montana?
Yeah. So the big expenses are just your classic overhead expenses. So we're in Bozeman, we are renting a facility, right outside of Bozeman. Which someone has graciously just donated paying all the overhead on that for us coming summer. Yeah, awesome. So that's been fantastic. The other big expenses are food and lodging for the participants. You know, we need 12 horses for next summer. So that's a big expense to lease those horses. We need a bigger trailer for next summer. So that's something that we're working out. What's the most economical way to get a trailer? And then, you know, those are the large, big expenditures. And eventually, you know, we have ways where a lot of these things will be one-time costs and we buy a really nice trailer right now and then we don't have to spend money on it, on that that item for another 10 or 15 years. And so a lot of this stuff is just a bunch of upfront costs, and eventually we'll own our own horses instead of leasing and borrowing other people's horses. And so there's a lot of this cost will get written down over time. Right. But all that, those fixed costs of facility rentals and hay and fuel and all that stuff that will just never go away is something that we're planning for.
It's one that seems so similar to the community that you and I both left, right? Where you do almost anything for that person or organization to succeed because you believe in it, right? And these types of partners that you've developed seem like they're cut from the same cloth, so to speak, right? And that they believe in what you're doing so much that they're willing to drive between states and, you know, 12 hours to do this for you. That's got to be comforting, right? That's got to be something that gives you some sense of connection back to the service. Right. At least it would feel that way to me. I don't know if it's the same for you or not.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, what you just said is the whole point of the exercise for us. It's the whole reason we're doing it is because you have this strong sense of community and this strong sense of being on a team and this values-driven organization with all these amazing people when you're in the military, and then you get out and you lose that.
Yeah.
So if you can get out of the military and join a profession that has that community, that has those values, that has those high caliber people and those amazing teams. And I mean, again, for me, when I got out and joined that community, I felt like I didn't miss a beat. And so the whole reason we're doing this is to give people who are transitioning out of the military the option to stay in a profession that is that communal and that team oriented. And so that you hit it perfectly. That's exactly what we're trying to do.
I got to ask Ben, as we wrap up, man, where'd the name come from? What is the name and where did it come from?
Yeah. So the name is Bear Hug Cattle Company. That name, so when I was a kid, my mom made me a painting on the back of an old door that hung in my room for 28 years. And it was a painting of a big old bear sleeping on a log, and it was underneath written Bear Hug Inn. And so when I built my house out in Montana, I took that painting and hung it up in my house when I finished it, and had been calling that the Bear Hug Inn. And then so the Bear Hug Cattle Company was just an extension of that.
I mean, it sounds like you're off to the races. And for those listening, horses, a trailer, and lodging and food, those are the big things Ben needs, guys. So if you're interested, or, you know, Ben, how can they get in touch with you to help donate and be a part of the cause?
Sure. Yeah. Our website is bearhugcattlecompany.org. And our Instagram is at bearhugcattlecompany. You can donate on the website, and all my contact information is on the website as well. So if anyone is listening that wants to talk about the program or ways we can help them get connected in the industry, or ways that they can get involved and partner with us in that, then please feel free to reach out to me anytime.
As Ben described, there's a lot of times in the military and in business that a difficult decision will land in your lap. You have to be ready for that. In Ben's case, he went against a specific order from his commander, but he did it for what he thought was the greater good. There's a lot that goes into being able to make a decision like that, and we're not always right. But the military is a unique place that places young officers and leaders in situations where they're faced with these difficult decisions. What we learn, right or wrong, makes us better able to deal with other difficult decisions in the future. I know for a fact that if I had been a single man coming out of the military, I would have jumped at a program like what Ben is putting together at Bear Hug Cattle Company. Part of me wishes I was still a transitioning veteran so I could apply for something like this. It just resonates on so many levels. Outdoors, difficult challenges, working with your hands, being a part of a high-functioning team, doing something better than yourself, learning a tangible skill, being fully immersed, a beautiful country. I mean, the list just goes on and on. I can certainly understand now why demand is outpacing their capacity to support. Please, if you feel moved to donate and support Ben and the Bear Hug Cattle Company in any way, reach out directly or to us and we'll get you connected. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these stories and insights, please leave us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website at agdconsult.com. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike DeSa, and until next time, stay frosty.